The NBA continues to make progress in its return to the court. The league has put together a health and safety manual of more than 100 pages for everyone who's going to be in Orlando. It's a smart plan, but the fear of the unknown is always looming.
The question for them and for every league, frankly, is how do you handle those things, the things that were unforeseen?
That's David Aldridge, editor-in-chief of The Athletic DC. He has covered the NBA for decades, and he joins us to address the ongoing discussions in and around the NBA's plans. I'm Seth Davis from The Athletic, and this is The Comeback, COVID-19 and the Return of Sports. We'll get to David Aldridge in a moment, but first, let's get you updated on what's happening around the world of sports. Major League Baseball is working its way back, we think. On Thursday, the Players Association presented its latest proposal to the owners that calls for a regular season of around 70 games at full pay. The owners had previously offered a 60-game season, full pay, but with an expanded playoffs this season and next, as well as an idea to bring back the designated hitter to the National League. The hope now is that the two sides will officially agree to a resumption of the season in the coming days. Dr. Anthony Fauci is raising concerns about football being played this fall. Speaking with CNN this week, Dr. Fauci said that unless the NFL places its players in quarantine for the entire season, it will be very hard to see how football could be played safely. Dr. Fauci's main concern is that the season would begin around the time there could be a second wave of the coronavirus. On Thursday, the University of Texas announced that 13 football players have tested positive for COVID-19. 10 more players are asymptomatic and in quarantine. The tests were given as part of the involuntary workouts the school resumed this week. And across the pond, the Premier League resumed its season on Wednesday with two matches with a full schedule on tap for this weekend. There were no fans in the stadiums, but Manchester City put a dozen or so fans on a jumbotron inside the stadium so they could react in real time. The league tested more than 1,500 people, both players and league personnel, and only one tested positive. And now to the NBA. The Athletic's Shams Charania reports that a 113-page manual has gone out to players outlining health procedures for their stay in Orlando. To discuss everything going on across the league, we're joined today by The Athletic's David Aldridge. He has covered the NBA for decades and is now the editor-in-chief of The Athletic DC. David, thanks for being on the pod today. So our colleagues, Shams Charania and Sam Amick, they got a hold of the NBA's health and safety manual. I assume that you've memorized all 113 pages because you know there's going to be a quiz today, right?
Absolutely. Sure. I'm on top of it for sure.
From what you've heard about it, what do you think about what the plan they came up with?
I mean, you know, look, I think they tried to cover everything that they could, certainly did a lot of work on that. There will obviously be things that they couldn't anticipate that come up. And the question for them and for every league, frankly, is how do you handle those things, the things that were unforeseen, the potholes that pop up out of nowhere? And that's where the rubber's going to meet the road about the NBA's response and every other sports league. But certainly, you know, it looks like they've tried to cover as much as possible. I mean, you know, I certainly think the players and their agents are not crazy about this idea of essentially having these monitors or bracelets or whatever euphemism you want to use for them, that they can be tracked, you know, on a constant and regular basis about in terms of their movements. They certainly have a question about why players and coaches and teams are essentially going to be quarantined for 3 months, yet Disney employees that will have at least some contact with these teams during that stay look like they're going to be able to come and go as they please with very little in way of quarantine. So there are questions, but the bottom line, again, is that most players, I think, and certainly all the teams that are going to participate want to be a part of this. They want this to happen. They want there to be a champion ultimately crowned for this year. So my sense is they will get this done, and they will work through, I think, what will be inevitable positive tests during the course of those months there.
That was my next question, David, because I feel like a lot of the discussion is, you know, how to keep players or coaches or whoever from testing positive. But to me, it seems just inevitable that somebody's going to get this thing. Do you sort of have that same mindset? And are you confident that not only the league, but the public can handle processing that information? Because, of course, I mean, the big moment in this whole pandemic nationally was when Rudy Gobert tested positive. So we're all going to have a flashback to that. Are you assuming that at some point, at least one player is going to get this virus?
I think somebody will, Seth. I don't know if it'll be a player or a coach or referee or, you know, or someone working the scorer's table. I mean, it could be any of those groups, right? I mean, this virus does not, you know, it has different outcomes for people. It does not have different rates of transmission. You know what I mean? Like, it may hurt older people more than it hurts younger people, but younger people get it now. You know what I mean? So athletes get it now. So it's not like because you're a player, you're immune to this thing. I think that there will be a positive at some point. There will probably be multiple positives at some point. And so the question becomes to me, what, you know, and that's where I'm talking about unintended or unforeseen circumstances. I think they know what to do with one or two people, but what happens if there's seven people on a team that test positive? What do you do then? What happens to a team? You know, even if you have bigger rosters, if a good to very good team or great team or championship caliber team loses three or four of its top players and is reduced to essentially a G League level team trying to win a championship, there's going to be some pushback on that idea. And so that's where I think we just don't know what's going to happen and how the fans and that are watching and the people that are watching react to it until we see what happens. And if it's just one or two, that's different. But if it's a whole, you know, good cross-section of a team, that's going to be an issue.
Well, when you talk about unforeseen circumstances, we're all watching these numbers in these specific areas around the country where numbers are spiking, and Florida is definitely one of those places. I assume people around the league are watching these numbers. Are you getting a sense yet that anyone's ready to pump the brakes?
No, because their rejoinder is, well, all the players are going to fly in private. They're not going to come into the, you know, the public Orlando airport that seemed to have had a significant number of positive tests. They're going to be flying in the private airports in that area. And remember, worst comes to worst, Tampa's only an hour away. You could fly into Tampa conceivably and drive in from there. They have options other than the public Orlando airport to fly in, and they continue to believe that they can hermetically seal essentially the Disney campus to the point where they're not going to be letting people come in that aren't going to be tested multiple times before they get there. And anybody that shows a positive test won't be allowed to come in. So they feel like, and again, this is what they're saying. Doesn't mean that's how it's going to come down, but that's what they're saying. They feel like they have an ability to kind of mitigate the potential hot spots in and around the Orlando area.
And in the midst of all this, we have this so-called Kyrie Irving call, 80 or so, a little more than 80 players supposedly on that call and possibly raising objections about resuming the season for a variety of reasons, not least is the social justice conversation and protests, everything in the wake of the George Floyd killing. How much support does Kyrie really have on these players, and how big of a movement is that?
It's hard to say. I don't know that I would feel comfortable putting a number on it in terms of percentage. I think that there are players, plural, who have concerns about going to Orlando for different reasons, some of which have to do with what Kyrie was talking about, but some are just kind of more generic health concerns, questions about that, and questions about what will happen again if someone tests positive, that sort of thing. I do think that there are players who want to use this, you know, the specifics of these circumstances with the NBA looking like it's going to be the first league to kind of get back on track of the major sports leagues in the States to really kind of push the NBA to do more. Nobody expects that players aren't going to be allowed to wear t-shirts or take a knee if they want to support protesting against police brutality and things like that. I mean, I don't think anybody expects the league to fine players who do those things, but those are gestures. You know what I mean? Those are, and they're gestures have meaning. Symbolism has meaning, don't get me wrong, but they don't address real reform and real change, and especially in the communities that we're looking at where NBA teams are, where we've seen some of these police killings and shootings. And I think some players are saying, look, let's at least see if the league is willing to kind of do more than just, you know, issue a well-crafted statement of support for Black Lives Matter. I mean, that's kind of the default. Well, of course, we would hope that the NBA would support Black Lives Matter at this point, right? So there are some players who are like, you know, let's see if we can push them a little bit to do some more things. There's other things that they could be doing in communities of, and especially in communities of color, that might have a little bit more impact. So I think that's where some of the players are.
I mean, I think it's a great conversation to have. I mean, some of these other players, Malcolm Brogdon, Austin Rivers, Ed Davis, to name a few, they're making the argument that to the extent that players want to have a voice in this larger social justice conversation, then the best thing that they could do is to get back out on the court and in front of the cameras. Does that argument have merit with you?
I mean, again, it has some merit to me because, again, I do think symbolism matters and gestures matter. But at the end of the day, people are going to remember them playing. And I think that's the point, is that if you get to the point where you're just now, where fans and people watching on TV simply say, well, I don't want to think about police brutality anymore. I just want to watch this game. I just want to watch this series. I just want to watch this finals. And then we'll talk about that afterwards. And that's what tends to happen with these events and these types of moments, is that there is an initial, you know, kind of unified desire to kind of say the right things about change and really make a good effort to look like you're on the right side and all of those things. And then after a few weeks, people tend to move on to the next thing. They tend to forget. And I think that's the concern, is that once the playoffs start, it's going to be all about, well, you know, we can't ask LeBron about police shootings in Los Angeles or misconduct in LA, because he's trying to win a championship and he's got to concentrate on that right now. So I think there's a concern that the games tend to overwhelm everything else once you start playing them in mass again. You know what I mean? So that's, I think, where some of the concerns lay.
Well, speaking of those games, the plan here is we're going to have 22 teams in Orlando, 22 of the league's 30 teams in Orlando. They're going to play their way to 16-team playoff and then play out the rest of the postseason. So, David, if you could be czar of the NBA, and let's face it, it's only a matter of time before you are, what, if anything, would you change about the league's plan to finish the season?
Well, I had said and written that I think it's not fair necessarily that, you know, you include these extra six teams who are tangentially in the playoff race, but really only Portland is the only one of those six teams that I think has a realistic shot at being in the playoffs, right? You know, that could conceivably have overcome, into eighth place in the West. These other teams are in because the league wants more teams in the playoffs race, because it'll goose up fan interest in those cities. I mean, you can't, you know, it's hard for me to make an argument that Devin Booker and the Suns, who are in 13th place in the Western Conference, you know, should be in any way involved in this playoff race, you know, in these games. They're in there because Devin Booker's a star. They're, you know, and the Wizards are there because Bradley Beal's a star, you know, and that's why they're there. And I just felt, and this is different from baseball. Baseball never started its season. It's one thing, you can make the argument in that case, well, we didn't have a season, so let's get as many teams in as possible. The NBA played between 62 and 68 games, depending on which team you're looking at. They've played almost 90% of their regular season schedule. These teams have had a shot. They've had a season to show they were playoff worthy. They didn't do it. So why did they get rewarded with, admittedly, a long shot, but still an opportunity to make the playoffs? I just don't think I don't think they're doing it for any other reason than they want more teams involved in this, and they want more games. And a lot of these teams have local TV contracts where they have to play 70 games, you know, to mitigate some of the, otherwise they have to give back a lot of the money that they got from the TV networks, from the local TV stations. So that's what I think the motivation is for a lot of these teams. And I just don't think that's right. I think that they've had a long enough season. Remember, the NBA played a 66-game regular season after the last lockout in 2011. Nobody is complaining about the length of that season. That was a representative season. And this is a representative season. So my view would be, just start the playoffs with your 16 playoff teams in Orlando And then I had an idea about what to do with the 14 non-playoff teams. I thought you put them in a tournament and you let them play for the first three picks in the draft this year. You know, you whoever wins the tournament gets the first pick. Whoever comes in second gets the second pick. Whoever comes in third gets the third pick. And then you just, you know, you just put the other teams in order. Because it would give teams like Atlanta, and we talked to Lloyd Pierce, their coach, yesterday for my Hoops Adjacent podcast. You know, they're not in the tournament. Those guys aren't going to play for 9 months. And how does that help competitive balance when a young bad team doesn't play for 9 months? At least under my scenario, they would play. They'd have something to play for against other NBA teams. And however you want to format it is fine with me. But I just thought that was a way that you could get all 30 teams to play. You could get the TV networks programming and you give them something meaningful to play for. That's just my idea. Doesn't mean I'm right.
That sounds like a lot of fun. So I know you follow all these other sports closely. For example, Major League Baseball doing everything it can to commit collective suicide. But you know, it does seem that, look, labor relations are always challenging between owners and players, but it does seem like the NBA is doing it as well, if not better, than any other league. Why is that?
Well, I think, you know, the chief reason is that the players union and the league have had a very good working relationship since Michelle Roberts became the executive director of the Players Association a few years back. They had a very seamless extension of their collective bargaining agreement to avoid a lockout. They've had incredibly good working relationship with regard to many issues, even when they've disagreed. I mean, the league wanted to have that smoothing concept in 2016 in terms of the salary cap, and the union said no, and you wound up with that huge spike in the cap that allowed the Warriors to sign Durant in 16. But for the most part, they've worked pretty well together, and they work pretty well together on this as well. I mean, you know, they just have a better working relationship than certainly baseball's union has with Major League Baseball, and think to a lesser extent the NFL union has with the NFL. I mean, they managed to get a collective bargaining agreement a few years ago. I mean, I know they have another one coming up, and there was at least some hope that they were going to come up with an extension. But I just think that Michelle and Adam Silver work really well together, and that kind of trickles down.
Last question real quick. At some point, we get to talk about basketball again, which is going to be fun. Sure. So if this does happen and the league really resumes its season, what's the one storyline you're going to be most interested in following?
Oh, good question. I think I would say, you know, it sounds kind of macabre, but just, you know, injuries, I think, are going to determine who wins this thing, as they do every year. But it's especially acute this year because of the long layoff. And it's just inevitable that players are going to get hurt. And so to me, it's which team's medical staff does the best job of prepping its players to be ready to do this sprint, because it's going to be a sprint essentially in terms of the postseason. And so I'll be fascinated to see what are some of the things that these teams are doing, especially with veteran teams, with older players who tend to need a little bit of time to kind of work their way into peak form. And I don't mean they're out of shape. What I mean is that they're older, their bodies just take more time to kind of get into that mode of championship level play. So how do they do that? How do they kind of jerry-rig the system so that they have their guys ready to go at on very short notice and ready to roll? I mean, certainly LA versus LA is going to be an incredibly compelling and I think what most people are hoping for in terms of Western Conference Finals, and what most people expect, are Clippers-Lakers. It's kind of what the Clippers have built themselves for and what the Lakers have built themselves for. So I anticipate that that's going to be, in terms of the on-court storyline, probably the biggest thing that everybody's going to be looking for.
Well, I hope we get there. Hope we can have those conversations. David, thanks for being on the podcast today. I know you're a busy man. Appreciate you and your friendship all these years, and hopefully we'll be talking about hoops pretty soon.
Seth, my pleasure, man. Stay safe. Thanks.
You too. My thanks to David Aldridge for joining us today on the show. You can hear more from him on his podcast, Hoops Adjacent. I'm Seth Davis, and this is The Comeback presented by The Athletic. Be sure to follow us on iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, wherever you access your podcasts, as we track the major issues surrounding the return of sports. Thanks for listening, everybody.